We get things underway this afternoon by welcoming into the program a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of Sugar, Salt, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, and his newest, Hooked, Food Free Will, and How the Food Giants Exploit Our Addictions. Michael Moss, thank you for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, and I'm so excited to be an honor to be part of that lineup for your show today.
Well, I love the last two books so much, and for anybody who didn't read Sugar, Salt, Fat, the term addiction might seem a little strong, but as you point out, sugar, salt, and fat are more effective at getting to the brain and do it faster than nicotine or just about any other highly addictive substance you can think of.
Yeah, and actually, Rick, if we'd had this conversation 5 years ago and you suggested to me that Twinkies were, like, addicted like heroin, I would have, like, thought that's, like, totally nuts, though. Who holds a convenience store armed robbery to get, like, junk food, right? And where are the harsh chemicals that you find in drugs and even sort of cigarettes and alcohol in snack foods and processed food? But I have to tell you, crawling back into the underbelly of this trillion-dollar industry and talking to drug addiction experts who now study food from an addiction perspective, as well as sort of these chemists and marketing people who work for the industry, I'm actually convinced that in many ways these products are even more problematic for us than alcohol, tobacco, and some drugs. And the reason I say that is even going beyond kind of the salt, sugar, fat, the additives that they use, they figured out ways to tap into our natural biology that draws us to food and has for millennia, but they've changed the nature of our food so much that now there's this incredible mismatch between what our genetics are telling us and what these products are delivering.
Yeah, and you point out that our biological drive to eat didn't matter all that much until they changed the food. So how did big food begin to change things up, I guess, back in the early 80s when this really kicked into high gear?
Yeah, so we love by nature food that's inexpensive. That meant sort of less energy expenditure of our part. It only made sense when you're in a hunter-gatherer society. Instead of running down an antelope for dinner, just grab that aardvark that's sitting there. So the food companies, you know, brought in these chemical laboratories they called flavor houses to mix and match and mimic the flavors in natural foods. But their overarching mission is to reduce the cost of food because they know if they can, you know, bring in a box of toaster breakfast pastries at 10 cents less than it was last week, we're going to get super excited about that. We're drawn by nature to food that's highly variable because that used to mean that we were probably getting enough different kinds of nutrition to make us healthy. So what do the companies do? They create the cereal aisle, which has 200 versions of sugary starch all there to kind of fool us into thinking we're actually getting real nutrition with those products. And maybe lastly, and more importantly, we're drawn by nature to calories, right? Calories is fuel. It was a matter of life and death for most of our existence. But now the companies are packing in empty calories into their snack foods. So we can sort of get as much as a day's worth of calories in a bag of chips without our body sort of recognizing that, our gut recognizing that, the brain recognizes it. So we don't put the stop on overeating.
Well, you mentioned snacking, and you point out in the book that Americans have essentially added a fourth meal to our day, that we average almost 600 calories a day through snacking.
They sold us hard on convenience. And this goes back to the 60s when more women began working out of the house and men didn't pick up the slack and start cooking more. So we turned to the food industry and said, can you help us out? And boy, did they. I mean, everything about these products we're talking about here, and it's not just snack foods and candy and ice cream. It's like 90% of the stuff in the grocery store is built for ultra convenience. And the hidden price in that is our health and our overdependence on these products. I mean, even before the pandemic, obesity rate had pushed past 42% in this country as a reflection of our overdependence on their convenience in these products.
We're talking with Michael Moss here on Downtown. Also very important to look at the power of food memory. And by the way, were we neighbors or something? Because I laughed out loud when you mentioned those Appian Way pizzas that were such a treat as a kid.
I was raised in California. I thought they were like a California thing, but when I was a latchkey kid, even from elementary school, I was like making Appian Way pizzas in the sixth grade. It's pretty incredible, right? But speaking of that, so memory, right? And that's bringing back memories, kind of talking about. I went into a Kellogg's research development factory where they were experimenting at a batch of Pop-Tarts that messed up. And they were dumping the dough into a big vat for disposal. That aroma wafting across the research development factory floor took me right back to elementary school, where I ate Pop-Tarts sort of walking into the house when I came home from school. Instantly, and I hadn't had a Pop-Tart in like 40 years. Memory is one of the things that I argue sort of makes these food products even more problematic than alcohol, cigarettes, some drugs, because we begin forming memories for these products at a really early age, possibly even when we're still in the womb, depending on what our mother is eating. And we hold those memories for life and often associate them with other emotions. And so that's why the industry spends so much money advertising, marketing. They're basically getting in our heads and creating memories. And so that's why the soda companies know when, you know, if they can get a soda in the hands of a kid when they're at the ballpark with their parent having the most kind of joyous moment of their life, that soda will forevermore get associated with their joy. In the later in life, when they're wanting a little joy and comfort, they will think of the soda.
I found it very interesting that you point out for the longest time the belief was that the stomach was the real problem in getting us to eat, and that led to the huge rise in bariatric surgeries, but it's the brain that we should be targeting.
Yeah, I think the brain is sort of, you know, all important. Addiction happens in the brain. Hunger happens in the brain. Our likes and dislikes for food. And it's kind of a combination of the two. And people who have undergone bariatric surgery as sort of a last desperate resort to try to control their eating will notice that the brain will still sort of activate it, and they can still end up getting cravings for the foods that they were trying to avoid by surgically shrinking their stomach.
I found it ironic that the companies that produce most of our convenience foods also now own all of the major diet plans. And it seems like a real dichotomy, because I got the impression from the book that there really are people within the big food world that sincerely want us to be healthier.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I still don't see this as this evil empire that intentionally set out to make us, you know, way overweight or otherwise ill on their products. I mean, these are companies doing what all companies want to do, make as much money as possible by selling as much product as possible. But I was astounded to learn that back in the late 70s, when obesity began to rise as a reflection of our losing control of their products, none other than the biggest processed food companies began buying up the biggest, most popular dieting methods, so that Weight Watchers, Slim Fast, South Beach Diet, Atkins became to be owned by big processed food manufacturers. But even more than that, you know, they marched around the grocery store, you know, starting to make kind of diet versions of their regular products. And so that's why, you know, we ended up in the freezer aisle looking at Hot Pockets made by Nestle and then Lean Pockets made by Nestle sitting right next to it. And I think what this did was just kind of, you know, again, sort of shifted the burden onto us to kind of figure out which one did we need this week and were they really all that different than the other. And I think the bottom line there, and you know, from doing this reporting and looking at this research and talking to experts, this is not our fault. This overdependence on these products is not a matter of a lack of willpower on our part, or, you know, executive function. These products are designed in a way that kind of robs us of free will in making decisions about what we eat and how much.
And we talked about memory. Can you explain the impact of sugar and fat in the brain, I believe it's the striatum, in creating what's called habit memory?
Oh, yeah. So there's new research. So a lot of people find that sugar is a trigger for cravings. And one of the things we've learned from drug addiction is that cravings happen so fast and so hard that it's almost impossible to sort of save you know, say no once they hit you. And so sugar alone is another thing. But what scientists have discovered recently is that sugar in tandem with fat activates a part of the brain known as the striatum where compulsive behavior, habit forming lives. And so it's the combination of those two things, which are found in things like milkshakes and chocolate chip cookies. And, you know, candy bars are as much sort of about fats and oils as they are about sugar. And so it's that combo synergistically affecting the part of the brain, again, where sort of willpower is not the issue.
What can we learn, Michael, from the humble fruit fly?
So one of the things that the companies are doing now in response to our growing concern and efforts to kind of change our eating habits is they're going around the grocery store again and reducing the amount of sugar in their products by substituting in non-caloric sweeteners, right? Sometimes cocktails, two or three of these in products. And not just soda, but like lots of stuff in the store. And there hasn't been a whole lot of research on how that affects us, our biology. Because think about it, you're tasting something sweet, you're expecting calories, the calories don't come in, how does the brain and the gut react? We really don't know, but it turns out one of our closest allies in the animal kingdom is that tiny little fruit fly. It turns out we love the same things. We love fruit, sweet things, fermented. They love beer. And so they did this experiment where they took some fruit flies, put them on their regular chow, and then added some of these non-caloric sweeteners. And the flies that got those non-caloric sweeteners went into starvation mode. It's like their little brains were screaming at them, you're not getting food, you're not getting calories, even though they were. And so they couldn't sleep, they couldn't sit down, they'd just flutter around, and the poor thing just like went bonkers.
So many people are dieting. You point out that if it becomes an obsession about the food we eat, the calories we're consuming, that in and of itself is also just another form of disordered eating.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think our trouble with food sort of happens on this spectrum. And at one end, there could be people who are binge eating and totally losing control. In the middle, maybe people who just kind of get a craving for cookies at 3 p.m. And then there's kind of like the, you know, the rest of us who just, you know, our trouble is just kind of the feeling that we've lost the beauty and the ritual of home-cooked meals with families and friends. And at the end of the day, you want to wish that we didn't have to think about food in this way. But I think the food companies have forced us to. And changing our habits now, after a lifetime of sort of hearing them tell us what we should value in food, is really hard and does take a certain amount of effort on our part. And of course, you can go overboard and become like crazy concerned about certain aspects of food when and miss the bottom line, which is this healthy for me? Is this you know, a balanced diet? Is this really food that I'm eating?
So what can we do? We are who we are. The companies are going to do what they do. But you offer some suggestions that I think make a lot of sense. And maybe the most important is to slow down, to make food an event, to savor it, to taste it, and to celebrate it, and not be rushing through and counting numbers and looking at charts and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think paying attention to it. I mean, they love to make products that sort of inspire mindlessness on our part, right? We're eating with one hand while we're doing something else. There are studies showing that people who watch TV while eating dinner will eat more and gain weight. So paying a sort of attention to it. I also like this idea of turning the tables on these big multinational companies and taking back things they took for us. And so this is a tiny thing, but in our house, we've been trying to, you know, drink less sugary soda. And we've managed to switch over to plain seltzer because there's something really great about the bubbles, the effervescence in seltzer. And even my 17-year-old now is able to drink plain seltzer and not miss the soda too much that he turns back to that. But the cool thing about it is that before there was sugary soda, there was plain seltzer. There's even a town in Germany called Seltzer, right, where the population's been around for centuries debating the merits of one spring water versus another. So I love this idea of these companies not really having invented these things that are causing us so much trouble. There's nothing wrong with salt, sugar, fat in the hands of a good cook, but having kind of taken those and corrupted them to their own ends and our now being able to turn the tables on them and find ways to use those things, even convenience, to our own benefit.
And one of the things you suggest is to spend more time in the perimeter, the outer aisles of the supermarket.
Yeah, that's where the produce is, that's where the meat is, if you eat meat, that's where the dairy is. I also sort of think that the more we can find ways to do our own basic cooking, the better off we're going to be. Let's speak about mindfulness, right? Just the act of sort of doing a little cooking. I have to tell you, Rich, I have a spaghetti sauce recipe now down to 93 seconds. And granted, if it simmers a bit, the family's more apt to actually eat it, right? But the actual work part is not that much. And I'm buying like a whole, you know, a can of whole plum tomatoes, and I don't have to get the massive amounts of salt and sugar that comes in some of the prepared versions of spaghetti sauce. And it costs less than the jars do. And doing kind of that basic cooking that focuses me on the food a little bit, gets the brain and the stomach and the gut expecting that food coming in. And I think the more that we can find ways to cook things for ourselves, that's a huge step forward in helping us change what we value in food.
And if you have kids, getting them involved in that process too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And creating new habits. You know, when our kids were young, you know, we wanted them to eat more broccoli because every nutritionist says, you know, try to fill up half your plate in vegetables, whole fruits, and you're like more than halfway home to changing your diet and improving your health. And my wife said, look, you know, if we just get them to try broccoli like 19 times, they'll love it. And there's something to that. Because actually, one of my scientists, I was pushing him to say, look, what's more trouble for us? Salt, sugar, fat, you know, convenience. And he goes, actually, Michael, I think we like what we eat more than we eat what we like, meaning that if you can get yourself to sort of shift over to a different way of eating, healthier, and stick to that long enough that you sort of begin developing these likes for it. Wow, that's just incredible.
The book is called Hooked, Food, Free Will, and How the Food Giants Exploit Our Addictions. And when you've read that, if you haven't already, go back and read Sugar, Salt, Fat as well. Michael Moss, it's been a real treat for us to talk with you this afternoon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.